gravity filter available. You know, if you were to throw 100 ball bearings at a magnet, most would bounce off. But if you placed them on the magnet, all would stick. The same principle applies in water filtration. Most filtration systems force water through the filter at 60 to 90 PSI, causing water molecules to race through the filter in less than a second. The Berkey Light is different. Water molecules take 5 to 10 minutes to pass through the torturous path of the self-sterilizing filters. This allows the proprietary media formulation to remove and reduce pathogenic bacteria, cysts, chemicals, herbicides, pesticides, organic solvents, foul tastes, odors, heavy metals, and nitrates. It is so powerful it purifies raw, untreated water from remote lakes, streams, and stagnant ponds.
Get the Advanced Berkey Light Purifier for only $279 by calling New Millennium, 888-803-443.
Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And the views of our guest this afternoon is going to be Dr. Jerome Corsi. Dr. Corsi, are you there?
Right here, Dr. Stan. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. I appreciate so much you taking time to be with us. And I didn't never understood that you'd actually worked in international finance for some years before you took on your new job as a syndicated columnist and writer.
Well, this is about my third career, writing for WorldNet Daily and writing books on politics. I for 25 years, after I got my PhD, I worked for 10 years in universities, and I did research. I taught some, mostly I did research with the federal government and different projects at different universities. The last university I taught at was the University of Denver in Denver, Colorado. And then I changed careers. I went for 25 years and worked in international finance. I specialized in creating broker-dealers creating structures where banks and other financial institutions like banks could participate in selling to their retail customers a wider range of products than bank products, including mutual funds, annuities, securities. And that was a very successful career. It was a time when the Glass-Steagall Act was still in effect, and banks had walls that divided them from insurance companies and securities firms. And I was finding ways to break down those walls and getting banks to offer a wider range of products to their customers. And I did that really from the early 1980s right up until I wrote Unfit for Command in 2004. So that was close to 25 years involved in that. I still have my securities licenses. I created two broker-dealers. I'm registered with the National Association of Security Dealers as a licensed principal. I have many principal's licenses, and I still have active insurance licenses in New Jersey in both life and health and property and casualty. I rarely use them these days, but I've maintained my licenses, and I have the experience of 25 years working in that financial services industry in the United States and around the world.
Well, that certainly gives you certainly a lot more ability to comment on what's really taking place, which is one reason I really wanted you to be with us. What was your PhD in?
My PhD was in political science.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I got it at Harvard in 1972, and I also, even as an undergraduate, I always had I had two majors in college. I majored in both economics and political science. And then when I got to Harvard, I continued to take a lot of graduate courses in political science, and I mean, that was my PhD in economics. I took additionally graduate courses in economics. So it was something I'd always studied, and then I'd always wanted to work in financial services, so when I got the opportunity, I felt that I had done enough research in universities and didn't want to continue in universities. When the Reagan administration came in, I decided to change careers, and I went into financial services.
Well, of course, I'm glad that you have this background, because I think it helps you to better understand what America faces today. And of course, this is the big problem, is that most people, myself included, really are only amateurs as we begin to analyze what's going on. But there's so many unanswered questions out there, and I thought that the talk, and incidentally the reason I had asked Dr. Corsi to be with us this afternoon is because he gave a talk. It was about a week ago. It was at the Eagle Forum meeting in Santa Rosa. It was the finest, most structured talk on what is going on today that I've heard. And although many of our listeners listen to us regularly and we have a guest on or are very, very knowledgeable, sometimes you need a structured talk to explain what's going on. And so in just a moment, why, of course, we're going to be back with Dr. Jerome Corsi, and we're going to be talking about what's really going on financially. Why did you pick up the story there, Jerry?
Well, Dr. Stan, what I spoke about out in California was that we're facing a pretty severe crisis now of assets in the financial services industry. And I guess probably the best place to begin is with the how this whole real estate bubble got created. And I point to 2003 and 2004, when Greenspan, who was then chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, kept interest rates artificially low. He kept them at 1%. And with interest at 1%, and with a lot of money being made available to banks and other lenders to lend, it led to a real estate bubble. In other words, if you remember that period of time, almost anybody who went into a bank and wanted to borrow money or a home loan was going to get it, whether or not they were really qualified. I mean, it was so much money to be available that the qualifications required were reduced. Also, because of the amount of money that was available to lend for homes, prices of homes went up all across the country, because you could almost take any home at that time and put a price on it you thought was reasonable, and it would sell very quickly, because the demand for homes was up and the financing was available. So, for instance, here in New Jersey, where I live, in the period after 9/11, as these rates were put low to help us recover from the recession that resulted from 9/11, we saw the value of our home and our neighbors' homes in this whole community I live in, near Morris Plains, Morristown, New Jersey. Prices about doubled. And around the country, you'd see equally California, other states with high demands, but even people in the middle of the country, their homes dramatically increased in value. And everybody thought this was a tremendous windfall, that we were all suddenly much better off because we had so much more money in the home equity. And banks at the same time were inviting people to take home equity loans, which many people did. They used their home as an ATM machine, and they took money out and used that money building the amount that they owed in their home. So when this bubble occurred, it was fine as long as the real estate prices started going up, kept going up. But around 2005, Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke, who's our current Federal Reserve Chairman, started raising interest rates. He was concerned that we were... the dollar was weakening.
Hold that thought right there, but we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest, of course, is Dr. Jerome Corsi, who actually has spent 25 years working in international financial markets, had a major in political science, but certainly also studied economics while at Harvard University in the graduate school there. And simply pointing out that the real estate bubble came about because the Federal Reserve Board under Alan Greenspan kept interest rates artificially low at about 1% for a full year in 2003 and 2004. And then, of course, there was money readily available to buy homes. And all you had to do was be able to walk into a bank and say you wanted to buy a home, and you could get money for it. And then the banks were encouraging people to take out home equity loans and use their homes as simply as a piggy bank. Pull the money out, go out and spend it, do whatever you want to with it. There is no tomorrow. And people have forgotten that when you borrow money, you got to pay it back. Or he who spends what isn't his and has to give it back or go to prison or get out of their house. But anyway, of course, then, of course, comes the day of reckoning when the interest rates begin to go up again. And so you pick up the story there, please.
Well, that's right, Dr. Stan. And so here you've got people who, just take a look at an increasing real estate market where a bank said, well, it doesn't matter if you're not qualified. If you have bad credit or some other problem, we'll give you a loan because the house is going to be worth more in the future, and even if you can't pay the loan, you can sell the house and make a profit. And the loans they were selling, also they didn't worry that they were interest-only payments or loans that had initial teaser rates in the first year that were not very high, but were intended to ratchet up in the second or third year. Because again, people were told, if you can't afford the rates when they're higher, just sell the house and you'll still make, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000, whatever. And as prices go up, everybody wants. But then when interest rates started to rise in 2005, this bubble burst because suddenly home loans were not as easily available. And people were going to have to pay more for their mortgages because rates were going up. And that caused houses to be more difficult to sell, and it caused depreciation in value across the country. Also, this bubble with so many houses selling at such high values brought new developers into the market who were building not only freestanding homes but condominiums and townhouses. So most markets saw a tremendous expansion in home building, new home construction. And this was great while it was happening. The economy was, you know, roaring along. The stock market at its height last October built up to 14,400. Everybody was thrilled. This much money in the economy was, you know, boosting construction, which then boosted all the other industries which supply goods for construction. And money was flowing. But as it slowed down, then the downward side of the cycle is not nearly as much fun. People who are finding that they're now in a house that, let's say, has $100,000 when they bought it, with a $95,000 or $100,000 loan, and some of these loans were made even at 110 or 115% of the house value. The lenders gave you money to fix up the property. So you might have a $115,000 loan on a $100,000 house. It turns out now to be worth only $85,000. Well, you can't resell it and make enough money if its current market value is $85,000 to pay off your mortgage, which is at $110,000 or $115,000 if you took out some extra money to fix it up. Even if it was just at $100,000, you're underwater. And underwater loans and housing create problems. People are now paying more because they have a mortgage from a high value from a former market that they can't get out of. And then the adjustments that occurred in these teaser rates, a lot of these loans started costing more monthly to maintain. And people in an economic slowdown were finding it much more difficult to meet those monthly payments. So we now are at a rate of maybe somewhere where over 1% of all mortgages in the country are in foreclosure. We're hitting the historically high rates of foreclosure across the country. And the subprime markets, these markets where people were lent money that should never have been lent at all, have almost totally collapsed. The markets are, the houses are being foreclosed left and right, and in some inner city areas and other depressed markets, you're finding standalone, unoccupied properties that have been foreclosed that simply cannot be resold. So the collapse of the real estate market in the bursting of this bubble has produced a crisis. It got compounded because the investment banks, going back to the 1980s, were figuring out how to buy home loans from the mortgage makers, the banks and the other mortgage companies like Countrywide, which became one of the largest mortgage makers. And they packaged these loans together in what was called collateralized mortgage obligations that were securities. And they were given very high ratings because the investment bankers convinced the rating agencies that they had constructed these securities so that regardless of where interest rates went, the mortgage-backed securities would continue to pay and would continue to have some value. But they never anticipated the kind of crisis or bursting of the bubble that we've experienced. Also, it spread into other markets. The collateralized loan obligations covered commercial lending, which was also a bubble, where companies looking for money to acquire other companies or to grow were given loans at very, you know, they thought favorable terms, but again, when economics turned down, it turned out a lot of those commercial loans should have been rated junk, but were not, and they were also defaulting when the companies couldn't meet their debt service on acquisitions that didn't go as well as they planned that they would. So you've got now somewhere in the range of $3 to $6 trillion of mortgage money, collateralized loan money, that is collapsing in a downward economy. And when the banks are holding these collateralized mortgage obligations or loan obligations, these securities in their asset portfolios, and the assets go down in value, there's no way that the bank can sell these collateralized mortgage obligations. When they mark them to market to say what they're worth so little that the banks may not have the assets they need to continue operating. So at that point, the banks are in an asset crisis. And an asset crisis means that the bank either is bankrupt technically or needs new capital in order to continue operating. Other banks like Bear Stearns had these portfolios, billions of dollars in investment portfolios, investing in mortgage-backed securities or other collateralized loan obligations. And frequently, these investment funds were leveraged as well. In other words, if they had $1 billion in one of these funds, they went and borrowed $5 billion or $6 billion more. Some of the leverage was up to 20 times. In other words, they go borrow $20 billion on $1 billion, and they invest that in the same kind of asset. They buy more mortgage-backed securities. So now, when the mortgage-backed security market's declining, these portfolios like Bear Stearns had could not even pay their debt service on the borrowing unless they sold the few good assets that they had. And so it became a Ponzi scheme. Very quickly, the investors realized that if they didn't get out first, they weren't going to get out at all. And these huge funds worth billions of dollars collapsed. And in collapsing, they consumed the remaining capital that Bear Stearns had, trying to pour good money into these worthless funds to pay off the debt servicing obligations and the investors who wanted their money back. That's where the house of cards started imploding. And this has been going on now since 2005, and it's been picking up pace. So here in 2008, we've now had failures of major institutions like Bear Stearns. We've even had banks like Citibank have to reach across to foreign investors, either the petrodollar, Arab sovereign wealth funds, or China, or Singapore, which has, you know, billions of dollars in foreign exchange reserves because we've been sending manufacturing and we've had to these countries outsourcing it. We've had a negative balance of trade. China's accumulated huge amounts, like 1.3 or 1.4 trillion of foreign exchange reserves, which is our currency that they're holding because of the negative balance of trade. We're importing much more from China than we're exporting, and as a result, China gets a lot of our currency, which they're able to hold in foreign exchange reserves. So, Dr. Stan, that means that this is an asset crisis that we're facing. And asset crises are much harder to work out of.
And what you're really saying is that a lot of our banks, it's not that they don't have any, it's not a liquidity crisis, it's a solvency crisis. And these banks, many of our major banks, are frankly insolvent. Would that be a fair statement?
Correct. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Right.
And if they had to fully mark their assets to market, in other words, say, what could I sell these assets for today? You might have half the banks operating in the United States without adequate assets to meet their reserve requirements. And what the Federal Reserve has been doing is they've created almost $1 trillion of loan facilities, but now they've extended even the securities firms, let them borrow on a short-term basis and use that money as if it were assets.
And, of course, they're having, this is highly inflationary. Aren't they actually creating a lot of money out of nothing?
Well, sure. Well, they're, first of all, holding loans as if they were assets. And, secondly, the loans they're holding is fiat money created out of thin air, which deflates the dollar.
Right. And, of course, I'm sure a lot of the people overseas, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Arab countries, and others that are holding American dollars, aren't really very happy as our dollar plunges and a race to the bottom. And then they're holding it, they're losing asset value, and what are they going to do? We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Jerome Corsi here at Radio Liberty. Well, you pick up the story there.
Well, I understand the bubble that we've seen in real estate is really only the first of the bubbles to go. I've been writing and trying to get ready to explain to people there's a couple more to come. Hedge funds started being created again in the 1980s. They were pretty exotic funds that invested in various strategies to try to evaluate whether stocks were going to go up or down or interest rates changed, so that no matter what happened, you would still have something that would be doing well. And these complex mathematical models would mean that the portfolio would come out whole regardless of various changes that were occurring in interest rates or other environments. But hedge funds were also highly leveraged. So you might operate a hedge fund. You might go out to CalPERS, the pension fund in California for state employees, which is worth billions of dollars. You might say, let me manage $1 billion of your dollars in my hedge fund. And when you got the $1 billion, again, you'd go leverage that. You'd go to a bank, and you might borrow $20 billion. And you'd put that all into stocks or bonds according to your complex mathematical model, typically stocks. Now, again, this is fine when the markets go up. And the stock market going up to 14,400 last October 2007, the hedge funds were doing fine. But with the stock market plunging, the stock market now has twice traded under 12,000, which in a few months is a drop of almost 2,000 points. Hedge funds are in the same problem that the leveraged mortgage-backed securities funds were in, that to pay the debt service on the borrowings that they invested in, now in a declining stock market, they're having to sell off the few good stocks that they have pay the debt service on the rest of the portfolio. And quickly it can become a Ponzi scheme. If we get a stock market that's trading closer to 10,000, which could happen, you're going to see hedge funds, another $3 to $6 trillion worth, begin to melt down just like the mortgage-backed securities have melted down. And there's another huge pool of money out there that is equally a bubble. It's called derivatives. Derivatives are so complicated, I don't think I can explain them to anybody. Maybe not even most professionals understand them. But they're managed by the Bank of International Settlements, which is a bank, I believe, headquartered in Geneva, an international bank. And they allow banks to make various kinds of bets. They engage in credit swaps, interest rate swaps, where one bank might hypothecate $1 billion and say, I'll pay you a fixed interest rate of X percent on the $1 billion I'm saying I've got. On the $1 billion you say you've got, you pay me a adjustable rate. And I want to hedge or, balance off my interest rate risk with this swap. Well, these are all generally hypothecated. There's not much in terms of real underlying assets backing these bets. But right now, the Bank of International Settlements says there's almost almost $700 trillion of these bets. That's $0.7 quadrillion.
I want you to hold that. We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Chris. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Dr. Corsi's described the first bubble, which of course is the housing bubble, and then associated with that with the collateralized debt obligations, the mortgages had been taken, had been put into loans and bonds, and these were bought by financial institutions all over the world, and as the people who certainly were paying on the mortgages were no longer able to pay, then of course the and we saw the foreclosures, we saw the value of houses dropping, and then we saw the value of the collateralized debt obligations, these bonds were made up of the mortgages falling, and you're talking of a major bubble with $3 to $6 trillion there that can be lost. And then of course we have a second bubble, and that's the hedge funds. These are people with a lot of money who leverage that, and they make tremendous profits when the market's going up. But when the market turns down, why, of course, these things are so vulnerable. And many of the hedge funds have already gone under, losing literally trillions of dollars. And there's potential for many trillions of dollars more going with the hedge funds. But then the third bubble, which nobody wants to talk about, is the derivative bubble. And Dr. Corsi simply says that these are swaps. They're so complicated, most people don't understand them. Even many bankers don't understand them. But according to the Bank for International Settlements, you're talking somewhere between $500 and $700 trillion in derivatives are out there. And this is the greatest concentration of money. The trouble is there isn't that much money in the world. So you pick up the story there, Dr. Corsi.
Well, I understand with these $700 trillion, that's, now we've got to go to a new term. We've got to go to a new number. We're at $0.7 quadrillion worth of derivatives. These complex bets, once the bets start going sour, once they go bad, in other words, interest rates move so solidly in one direction that one side of these bets is losing totally and the other side is winning totally, there's no balance, well, then they're just going to start defaulting. And as they default, it's like housing foreclosures. You've got all these obligations out there which the banks are counting on, which are on their balance sheet as assets in one form or another, that are, again, worth nothing. In fact, they may even cost the bank. There may be obligations involved in unwinding these derivatives, where the bank has got to spend good money to unwind a derivative position that is worthless, defaulted by the other side. And $700 trillion of these bets worldwide, unwinding and defaulting, is a magnitude of an economic crisis that the world has never faced. It's unimaginable. This is a kind of crisis that, as it unwinds, could have half the banks in the world overnight being insolvent. And nothing they can do about it. They're just, again, it's like when you go back to the home loan. The Congress keeps saying, well, we'll pass a bill and people won't be made to foreclose. We'll finance them in a new loan. Well, that's fine. If somebody is in a $110,000 mortgage in a house that's now valued at $80,000, it's nice to think you're going to come in and give them a new mortgage at $80,000. But who's going to take the loss? The loss, that has to be assumed somewhere between the loan that was actually originally made at $110,000 and the value of the house, which is now $80,000. Either the taxpayer takes that loan, or the bank, or the homeowner takes the loss. And, it's very hard to settle this out. It's nice to say, well, let's make sure the people who are in foreclosures don't lose their homes. Well, how about the people then who are still paying their mortgages? Why don't they say, let's just stop. If we just stop paying our mortgages, well, the government will come and bail us out, too, and we'll get out from these underwater mortgages, and we'll put that on the taxpayers' burden, too.
But remember, what happens to the people who've lent the money that,
loss
that bought
has
the
to
house?
Be taken. Somewhere the loss has got to be taken. And right now, all these plans to bail out homeowners are failing because the taxpayers can't take trillions of dollars worth of home losses. They're going to have to be registered, and the lenders who made those loans or people walking away from their homes with nothing. This is happening around the country, and it's why home lenders like Countrywide have also gone bankrupt, because the losses they've had to take have overwhelmed the amount of capital they have, and they're bankrupt.
And, of course, this thing is just going to keep on cascading, and cascading there is...
melting down.
Right.
Because ultimately, there's probably, let's just say, $3 trillion in losses in the home market, $6 trillion in the hedge fund, and maybe $200 trillion losses in derivatives, all of which somebody's got to take.
And there's not that much money in the world,
so
then what happens?
Not that much money in the world.
The whole will be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, of course, is Dr. Jerome Corsi, and we're simply talking about what's really going on out there. And, of course, this is a very clear description of where we stand today with bubble after bubble after bubble, which is going to have to be burst one way or the other. But, of course, what you're really talking about is the fall or the crumbling of this whole financial system, which is built upon debt. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Yes, the whole financial system built on debt is collapsing. And as it collapses, there's not much good solution for it. The current solution that we're using, which is simply to print more debt money, Federal Reserve prints, has now close to $1 trillion in various discount windows or other facilities to lend to banks. Banks can overnight or now up to, say, a 28-day window, borrow the money they need to have enough assets to keep running. But, you know, you can't continue to run a bank where your assets are borrowed money, because that constantly has to be repaid. So at some point or other, the bank is going to be insolvent. It's going to need new capital. Now, the solutions to this crisis are not very good. I mean, that's why I've written, I think that this is an engineered crisis, and it's going to force us into a global economy. Because let's just take the capital that's needed by banks to keep operating. The Federal Reserve and the Treasury have been quietly conducting discussions with the Arab Sovereign Wealth Fund, which are petrodollar funds. They're probably worth about $1.7 trillion. And the discussions are they're going to need that money to be reinvested in the banks, which are going to mean that Arabs from Dubai and other countries in the Persian Gulf are going to end up owning major equity portions of our banks and brokerage firms. And we've never had that before. It's begun to happen already. 20% of NASDAQ, our second largest financial market, has been sold to Dubai. Most people don't even realize it's happened. Now, there are major questions. If Dubai owns 20% of NASDAQ, can they use that investment for political purposes? Can they say, we don't like such and such a policy of the U.S. government, and so we're going to liquidate our investment at a discount price in NASDAQ? We're going to, basically have economic clout over you because of the equity we own in your financial institution.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Jerome Corsi. Talk about the implications of becoming a debtor. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Jerome Corsi, of course, who's worked in international finance for some 25 years. And we've talked about the bubbles, first of all, the housing bubble, the CDO, collateralized debt obligation bubble, which many of, the banks have these bonds, and they're simply not worth the paper they're written on, as they're worth only a fraction of the amount of money that the banks and the hedge funds and the pension funds and other financial institutions paid for them. That's the first bubble, perhaps $3 trillion. And then the hedge fund bubble, which may be three or four times that. But then the derivative bubble. And the derivative bubble is about 700 trillion dollars. And of course, Dr. Corsi is saying that there is no way out of this. He looks at this and says, this has to be a manipulated crisis. And he thinks, as I do as well, that this whole crisis has been created, in an effort to take us into a global currency. You can't have a one world government unless if you have sovereign nations with sovereign currencies. What's the obvious solution? Why, of course, you go ahead and you destroy the sovereign currencies, and of course the nations have no alternative. They have to have a currency of something, and then we can move towards a global currency. Well, Dr. Corsi, before we go on, would you like to mention your website? Certainly you write for WorldNet Daily. Do you have any other website you'd like to
know? No, WorldNet Daily. I'm a staff reporter on WorldNetDaily.com, and I'm writing there almost every day, WorldNetDaily.com. And my book, The Late Great USA, The Coming Merger with Mexico and Canada, that's my current book. It became a New York Times bestseller. It's into its fourth printing. And it's also, we did a videotape, a DVD, rather, of the book. I did a speech out in Oregon. A speech went on for about 3 hours, and we added captions to it. The DVD of The Late Great USA is available on WorldNetDaily as well. And you can get them both there. Amazon.com is selling the book. You just have to search my name, Jerome Corsi, C-O-R-S-I. That's Jerome with a J. And the book is still selling as strongly almost as it did the day it was printed. So it's done extremely well.
I'm certainly glad it is. That's The Late Great USA. And everybody gets, of course, in the background of this. North Atlantic Union, that they're planning to destroy the sovereignty of our nation and of course merge the United States with Mexico and Canada, and of course this is being done very covertly because they know the American people don't want to give up their sovereignty and their freedom, but of course there are people in positions of power who have a different agenda, because of course they certainly do not look to American patriotism. Their loyalty is this globalist idea, a one-world government, and with my belief is in a one-world religion as well. Well, Dr. Corsi, then where are we going from here? We've seen the three bubbles. It doesn't seem like there's any way possibly out of this. Everything the government is talking about, they're talking about putting up $100 million so they can counsel 250,000 people who've lost their homes. $100 million, 250,000 people, that's about that's going to be about $4,000 for each one of the people, but they're just going to counsel them. They're still going to lose their homes. It's almost like they're saying, well, we're going to counsel you so you won't feel so bad that you've lost your home and your investment.
Well, the problem is that, so people say, what do we do with this? How can we survive this? I tell people that one of the things they need to do is get out of debt. People need to take a look at their mortgages and to the extent they can pay them down. Or get out of credit card debt. Pay credit card debt. Do everything you can not to increase credit card debt. And because people say, well, what shouldn't I have? I can pay off all my debt with, dollars that are worth less. Well, that's fine, but getting a hold of dollars is always the difficult part in these kind of crises. I mean, I remind people that, in the Depression, houses didn't cost very much. You get a good house for $25,000, but who had $25,000? That was the problem. And again, in a coming crisis like we're facing, getting a hold of money is going to be the issue, which is why you don't want to be in debt. If you're not in debt, then at least you can live in the property that you've got, and you won't lose it. That's number one. I also tell people that if they have investment dollars, not to count on dollar-denominated investments, even their 401ks or their IRAs. If they're in mutual funds or other dollar-denominated investments, those are going to be worth less and less, not only because losses are being taken in the market, but because the dollar itself is worth less. And when you get your dollar value out of those investments, it may not buy nearly as much as you thought it would in a weakening dollar. And the third or fourth things I do, third thing, tell people to buy gold. If you can have diversify investments and buy gold, do it. But don't buy gold stocks. Buy gold that you can actually hold on to physical gold. And the last investment I consider to be worthwhile right now is, I think Swiss francs are about the best currency remaining. And if people can get Swiss franc investments, and again, that Swiss franc investments, not in a dollar fund investing in Swiss franc companies, but really a Swiss franc investment fund, and you can get that, you know, good brokers might be able to help you reach across and get into some investments that are truly in Swiss francs. These are the kinds of strategies you can use. And people who do have cash will be able to buy properties at deeply depressed values. I mean, at the Depression, anybody who had cash often came out ahead of the game. But you have to be able not to be in a debt position in order to use the cash that you've got. If you're going to want to buy properties without incurring big mortgages, that defeats the purpose as well.
Well, you know, I think the thing that we're seeing, of course, the rise in prices of so many things. The oil is going up because the dollar is going down. The price of food is going up because the value of the dollar is going down. And more people are getting laid off. I mean, last month they lost 80,000 jobs here in the United States, and that may only really be an underestimate. I don't know how many, but they'll admit they lost 80,000 jobs. And so more and more people are losing their jobs. The building industry is shutting down. The housing industry is shutting down. The financial industry is shutting down. Certainly our manufacturing is not doing that well. And certainly the automotive industry is shutting down. People really, if they begin looking around, will find more and more people out of work. And going along with that, of course, prices are rising. So I think we're in for some very, very difficult times. And so certainly other than getting out of debt, buying gold if people can, and getting it, of course, into Swiss annuities or Swiss something denominated in Swiss currency, what are your other suggestions? Any other suggestions?
Those are the major ones. I think people need to make sure that they're, you know, worrying about jobs is appropriate, worrying about... There's so many jobs that have been outsourced. We've lost 1 million jobs to China since the Bush administration's taken over. And we've got economists like Alan Blinder at Princeton saying that as this global economy continues, you know, if you allow the multinational corporations to establish a base in North America or, you know, a transatlantic basis of operation, which is in the works with the Transatlantic Economic Council that was created a year ago in April, the corporations will go use slaves wherever they can find them. Right now they're in China, but if China gets too expensive, they'll go find slaves somewhere else to manufacture the goods. So Alan Blinder's saying we're going to lose 40 million jobs outsourcing, largely to India and China and other slave areas, in the next 2 decades.
And I think that figure really needs to be repeated, 40 million jobs. I mean, and this is Alan Blinder, who's really in favor of this globalist concept,
right.
But he realized the implications of what we are doing because, of course, we've removed any tariffs. And, of course, it's much easier to produce things over in China or in some other country with slave labor than it is here in the United States. And we're going to lose most of the rest of our industry. This is the tragedy. And most Americans say, just can't really believe it's going to happen. Not only that, but of course, Social Security is running out of money. Medicare this year, Medicare will actually spend more money than it takes in. Well, they're going to say, but if we're going to finance it from the Medicare Trust Fund, you know, we may be spending more, but we've got that Trust Fund. There's nothing in the Trust Fund. There's nothing in the Social Security Trust Fund other than an IOU from a country that is having to borrow $2.5 billion a day to pay its bills. And I think we're well on the way to being bankrupt. What do you think, Jerome?
Well, I think so. I mean, Dr. Stan, look, once a year, the Treasury does a gap accounting of the U.S. federal budget, gap accounting being generally accepted accounting practices. And what this financial report of the United States on a gap accounting basis has shown is that, you know, our deficit, when you consider the net present value today, of the future obligations that were occurring today on Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security, we're running $7-8 trillion deficits a year. and the accumulated deficit from these obligations that are unfunded but yet incurred is like $53 to $60 trillion. Now, there's no way that we can fund $60 trillion worth of unfunded obligations. So it means that there is no plan to pay future Social Security or Medicare benefits of the retiring, you know, baby boomers who are in the process of starting this year to seriously retire. And over the next two decades, as that retirement unfolds, the federal government is technically already bankrupt. Now, in that kind of a bankrupt situation, the only way these problems can be solved is what is called monetizing the currency. Another way that's expressed is hyperinflation. In other words, in Germany, when the currency became worthless, when obligations were so out of whack and money was just being printed to meet obligations, which is what we're doing today, you might get your Social Security check, and it might be the $1,000 or $2,000 or whatever thousand you're expecting, but good luck trying to buy anything with that. And we're seeing the impact of that already starting with our deeply depreciating dollar. Today, commodities like oil, food are going up dramatically in price because the oil-producing companies won't sell oil for what the dollar used to be worth. The dollar has about lost half of its value under the Bush administration. It was in January 20th, 2001, when George Bush took office, the dollar was about 87 cents to the euro. Today it's close to $1.60 to the euro. So it's about lost half of its value. The dollar has begun trading at 70. Traded in the middle of March at 70.71 on the U.S. dollar index. That's the lowest it's ever been. So with the dollar losing value, commodities are going to go up in price. Now, I can foresee easily $120 a barrel for oil. Gold, I can easily see going back over $1,000 an ounce. The markets are manipulated. That's another thing you've got to realize is the Fed and the central banks continue to manipulate all the markets. They do their best to depress the price of gold. The Federal Reserve, through another complex set of transactions called repurchase agreements, is every day putting out billions of dollars of its securities to primary dealer banks to try to manipulate the markets. And I regularly follow the repo agreements. I think the recent bubbles we've seen in the stock market up to about $12,600 completely. 12,600 points completely reflects the amount of repo money, repurchase money, the Federal Reserve is letting out every night to the primary dealers to make bets on the economy to pump up the stock market. That won't last. We'll come to a point where the stock market will again begin going down. Nor can the central banks sell enough gold. They don't have enough gold to depress the price of gold for very long. They may get it to hover around 900 again, but that won't last very long. It'll quickly turn around and go up to 930. That'll go to 960, and pretty soon it'll be over 2,000.
Well, we certainly see really I believe is the demise of our financial system, and people don't understand really what's going on. In fact, it was Lenin who said, there is no way to better way to destroy a nation than to debauch its currency, and not one person in a million will understand what's happening.
That's right. And what will happen to understand is people will be said, well, look, the solution is your dollar is not buying you anything. So let's give up the dollar. Let's go to an Amero. Let's go to a currency that is a regional currency. And like the euro, the Amero will be stronger. Well, the euro is stronger. The euro is stronger now by the dollar by a lot. It's never been as strong to the dollar. But the euro hurt middle-class people in Europe when it was put into effect. And the euro, comparable, the Amero, will equally hurt middle-class people when it's put into effect. I mean, I've begun to explain that to people by, let's say the Amero is declared, and you'll be able to go into the bank and for $5 you'll be able to buy one Amero. but the prices will still be as if they were in dollars. In other words, a car that costs today $20,000 will cost 20,000 Amaros. But when you went in and turned in your $5, you only got one Amaro. So that's how the currency, when it changed, is in effect a devaluation.
In fact, certainly you remember, of course, meeting of Orlean Kula at the meeting we were at here about 2 weeks ago. And Orlean's husband is German, and he'd gone over to Germany. Somebody had set up a trust fund for them, and they were looking forward to enjoying it in their retirement years. And it was worth about $300,000 a couple of years ago. And once they went into the euro, suddenly the trust fund is worth about $100,000. And, of course, because of the euro, why they lost two-thirds of the value. Well, the same thing is going to happen here as far as the dollar. And, of course, I really think that probably they're even going to lose a great deal more of the value of the trust fund over in Europe. Because I think the euro is a fiat money. Every currency in the world is a fiat money. This is what people don't understand. And they are all inflating and destroying value. Would that be a fair statement?
It's correct. And what will happen is that a new set of currencies will come out in which these losses will be absorbed and the unfunded obligations will be taken care of and the loser will be the middle class.
And, of course, this is, I think, exactly what has been planned all along. I mean, this whole thing is really so cleverly being put off, and the average individual cannot understand that there really are people who spend all their time figuring out how they're going to get the best and how they're going to change the structure of our society. A middle-class society is a good society where, of course, the majority of the people are happy. But, of course, the middle class also be the ones who might take a stand against this tyranny that I think is coming. Destroy the middle class, impoverish the people, they will accept an authoritarian structure of society. Well, Dr. Corsi, we have 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Well, I think I understand that this has been a good attempt to kind of go through the ABCs of what's happening step by step and to show people in a logical progression why a mortgage bubble was predictable when interest rates were kept so artificially low almost for 2 years by Greenspan and the Federal Reserve at 1% for 2003 and 2004. And then as the crisis unfolds, and if people just look at their lives, take a look at how much it's costing for gasoline today. Now, gasoline that even a year ago was $2.25 for a gallon is $3.25 for a gallon. Headed towards, you know, $4 a gallon. And food, look at what it costs to get food. We've been told for years that there's no inflation. But yet, you know, you go to the supermarket and you take $100 and you'll be lucky to get 2 bags of groceries, and there's going to be no filet mignon in those 2 bags of groceries. These are the impacts of a declining dollar. And when these credit bubbles burst, and, you know, they say, well, it makes no difference to me that Bear Stearns goes out of business. Well, yes, it does, because there's a tremendous amount of losses being absorbed, either by the U.S. taxpayer, by printing money, or truly by the shareholders of Bear Stearns, who lost a tremendous amount of capital. Those losses make an impact upon everybody's ability to have a decent living. The only winners in this are the multinational corporations, who at the very top are manipulating the entire situation through a set of unfair rules, where once again they're going for a race for labor at the bottom. They're being given a green light to use slaves in China or wherever else they can find them. And the middle class is being squeezed, told it's too expensive to be employed, and that everything the middle class needs to consume is going to suddenly become at a very dear price. This is where we start moving towards a two-class society. And, you know, the jobs that can't be sent overseas, we import a Mexican underclass to do. You can't send your lawn overseas to be mowed, but you certainly can import underclass workers from Mexico to do the job at very low wages. And the entire thing has been concocted by the multinational corporations paying the politicians and advancing this globalism so So these unfair trade agreements, you know, if you oppose them, you're called a protectionist. Well, no, I'm not a protectionist. I just want international trade to be done on a fair basis, where the rules where we trade by China are fair to the U.S. worker.
Hold that thought for me. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Jerome Corsi. Thank you so very much for being with us. We're out of time. It's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much.
Always a great pleasure and honor. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Great to be with you.
God bless. Bye-bye.
God bless.
All right, fine. Well, that was Dr. Corsi. And of course, if you'd like to get the entire talk, it is available. We talk during the breaks. But you get the general theme that we've had three major bubbles. And, of course, this whole thing is coming crumbling down around us. And, of course, this thing, everything they're doing to correct it is wrong. I mean, if you look at the government, federal government solutions, why, of course, they simply are not going to work. Because they do not want it to work. Because they want a crisis, because if they can destroy the value of our currency, then, of course, they're going to be able to bring in a new currency, a new global currency, privately issued, backed by gold. And people will be desperate, of course, for something of inherent value because, of course, they've lost everything that they have. And this is a very convenient means of wiping out the middle class. They know exactly what they're doing. Now, we have a great talk. It's called the Financial Tsunami, and it comes with a syllabus. We have a talk called the Financial Meltdown. It's not a talk. It's a pamphlet. It made up some of our newsletters. And then, of course, we have the pamphlet called The History of Money. You have to understand there's nothing new under the sun. This happened in ancient Greece. And it was Aristotle who said there's absolutely nothing wrong with fiat money as long as we have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in kings. And certainly Daniel Webster, speaking about what was happening to the finance, said, you know, there is certainly no better way, of course, to cheat the workman through the delusion of paper money. And of course, this is exactly what's going on today. There's a delusion of paper money, and people do not understand that this whole thing is planned. And of course, this has happened time and time and time again. Of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money. And look in your purse, do you see gold and silver? No, you see paper money. Daniel Webster, back in the 1840s, understood what was going on. And Alan Greenspan, writing in 1965, said, in the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. And that's what they're doing, ladies and gentlemen. They're going to destroy everything you've worked for through inflation. They know what they're doing. The central bank is a privately owned central bank. The Federal Reserve System is not a branch of the federal government. It's a privately owned central bank created by the bankers for the bankers, and of course to enrich themselves. And tied into that is this whole drive towards world government. So anyway, if you'd like the information, our talk on the financial tsunami with the syllabus, certainly our pamphlet on the financial meltdown, the pamphlet on the history of money, the book, which I think is by far the best, if you like to read books, is The Creature from Jekyll Island, which we carry. We probably sell 20 a week. And then, of course, the little tiny book called The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, because it is a conspiracy of the wealthy to become more wealthy to impoverish the people. And finally, the little book written over 100 years ago by Andrew Dickinson White, Fiat Money Inflation in France. And when you see what happened in France in 1789 when they did exactly what we're doing, why, it's like deja vu all over again. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family and help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day on almost 60 outlets across the nation, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, or really 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are under attack today, and the very financial stability of our nation is being systematically destroyed as part of a very planned, well-planned contrivance, and not one person in a million will understand what they're doing. So please go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Of course, listen to our programs. Encourage others to listen there on the Internet. You can hear them 4 hours a day live, and then pray for America, pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty.